All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, Chief Warrant Officer, helicopter type pilot, 1969 in Vietnam. We got an interesting program today, a couple of really great things that are going to happen. We're going to be talking with General Chuck Horner in just a moment, and he's written a song for another Chuck, and that is our local Medal of Honor recipient, Chuck Kettles, Lieutenant Colonel Chuck Kettles. And so we're going to get to them in just a second. And I want you to make sure that you stick around because we're going to have Lee and Vista Boyland on the program in about 10 or so minutes to talk about their trilogy of books called Clash of Civilizations. And I'm telling you, folks, you got to stick around for this story because these are very realistic. It's a fictional story. I got to remind you that with everything that seems to be going on in the world today, that these books are fiction. But after we talk about them, I think you're going to be taken aback a little bit about the potential of what these books do talk about. So make sure that you stick around for that. But right now, I want to bring on the air General Chuck Horner. General, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you on. And everything got all taken care of. So we've got your song all queued up and everything else. And I wanted to also bring on the air right now, if we can, Lieutenant Colonel Chuck Kettles. My other Chuck, welcome.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, General, you've written this song for Lieutenant Colonel Kettles. Tell us a little bit about why you did that.
Sir, to clear things, I'm not a colonel. I'm just a regular citizen who happened to see Mr. Kettles received the Medal of Honor, and his heroic things that he did with other veterans and men and women who served our country. I just thought it was a great story. I thought he was a great man, and I wanted to write a story and let people know and hear what it was a little like being over there under fire.
Well, I'm sure that after listening to your song, I think our people are going to understand that a little bit more. I apologize for my finding the wrong. It's one of the problems with the internet, right? You go and you find the wrong people. But
that's all right, sir.
Well, still, nobody's questioning your patriotism or your dedication to this story. Colonel Kettles, have you met Mr. Horner?
Yes. Yes, several times.
Okay, so that part I got right. I want to make sure I got that. Well, one of the reasons that Mr. Horner wrote this was that Colonel Kettle's birthday was on January 9th, and he just celebrated the 50th anniversary of his 38th birthday. And the other thing that he had on there is that he wanted to make sure that people were aware of what Colonel Kettles did back in May of 1967 when he was involved in the action that resulted in his receiving the Medal of Honor. Colonel Kettles, for those of you that are not familiar with it, I think you can safely go to the internet and Google in Colonel Charles Kettles and the whole story would show up. But this is a man after my own heart because he flew helicopters, which of course I did too, and I like that part. Who went back into a landing zone to pick up some eight survivors, really, that he had thought had already been picked up. And this was one of those long days, wasn't it, Chuck?
Yes, but most of them were, as you experienced it yourself.
Yeah, some of them got to be a lot longer than others, and some of them got to be more dangerous as the day seemed to progress once in a while. But I wanted to really just point out to our audience is that as the platoon leader of this particular platoon, when you found out that eight people had been left in the landing zone, you immediately turned around and went back to get them. And this was not a cool LZ. This was a very, very hot LZ, and there were not only were the bad guys down there, but we had jets that were dropping bombs and all kinds of bullets around to protect the people that were on the ground. So there's a lot of excitement going on as a result of that. So when you listen to this song, I think you'll appreciate it. So anyway, I just wanted to let people know that, you know, go look up Colonel Kettles on the internet, and you'll find out the citation there. It's a pretty amazing story, and I don't want to say too much except that he's one of the people that I admire greatly, and I want to wish you myself a very happy birthday.
Well, thank you.
All right. So, Mr. Horner, we've got your song queued up. We're going to play this, and then we'll go out, and then we'll come back with the second half or the second part of our program. So right now we've got our piece of music called Just Another Day. Is that right, Mr. Horner?
No, it's called We Gotta Try.
We Gotta Try. Okay. I'm having a bad morning. I don't even know what time of day it is.
It happens to all of us.
Excuse me. Yes, the song is We Gotta Try. So here it is, ladies and gentlemen. We Gotta Try.
It was just another day in the life of a soldier, this weak and humble man with his weight on his shoulder. When Kettles heard the news, there were 44 soldiers pinned down. He went back once more. He didn't hesitate. Soldiers out there somewhere in the jungles of Vietnam. There's a mother somewhere back at home waiting to hear from a daughter or son. We gotta get those soldiers out. They gotta know we tried. We can't leave them there to die. We got to try. Now the sun has gone down on a day I won't forget, when three times before we flew in this hornet's nest. I've never seen the sky on fire like this before, and I've never been this close. Knocking on heaven's door, but there's still eight more soldiers on the ground. There are soldiers out there somewhere in the jungles of Vietnam. There's a mother somewhere back at home waiting to hear from a daughter or son. We gotta get those soldiers out. They gotta know we tried. We can't leave them there to die. We gotta try. And we flew away to safety. No soldier left behind. With the fire raining down on us, we made it out in time.
May 15th, 1967, started as a hot Monday morning. Soldiers from the 101st Airborne were battling hundreds of heavily armed North Vietnamese.
All right, that was We've Got to Try, and that was written by Charles Horner for Lieutenant Colonel Chuck Kettles. Action in Vietnam in May of 1967. So I want to thank you both very much, Mr. Horner, for writing the song and getting it to me. I appreciate that greatly. And Colonel Kettles, again, very much thank you, and a very happy birthday to you, and I'll be seeing you soon, I hope.
Okay, sir, well, thank you.
All right.
Sir, I'd like to point out,
go ahead.
Give credit to my producer, Pete Palazzolo, who contributed on the song, and his studio is in Windsor.
All right. Well, good.
Thank
and they
you
can,
very much.
Well, where can they find this song? I've been so messed up today. They can find this song on YouTube.
On YouTube, just go to Charlie Horner and type in We Gotta Try.
Okay. It's there. There are pictures. There's a kind of a little slideshow that goes along with the whole thing. So I encourage
right.
people to
yes, sir.
I encourage people to do that. So that's Charlie Horner, We've Got to Try on YouTube, and I think you'll really enjoy it. Thank you, gentlemen, very much for being on the program.
Well, thank
You're
you
quite
for
welcome.
Having
Have a great day.
All right, you too.
You too.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you again. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to have Lee and Vista Boylan on to talk about their trilogy of books entitled Clash of Civilizations. You're listening to Veterans Radio. And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we're playing all patriotic music because it's America First today, and it's America First every day if we can. I want to encourage folks, if you've got a question or you want to get in on the conversation, you can give us a call here at Veterans Radio. The local number is 734-822-1600. That's 734-822-1600. Or if you'd like to call us toll-free, you can do that as well, 844-838-1600. That's 844-VET. 1600. You can follow us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. All the other different forms of social media that I don't have to know how to use, but you all do. So I think that's great. So joining me on a program right now is my guest for this rest of the program is Lee Boylan and his wife Vista, and we are going to be talking about their books, a bunch of their books, but primarily three of them. It's called The Clash of Civilizations, and we'll get into that in just a second. Let me tell you a little bit about Mr. Boylan and Vista. I met them a number of years ago at the Military Writers Society conference. I can't remember if it was in Florida or if it was in Dayton, but I know it was one of those. And Mr. Boylan is qualified to write about all kinds of weapons because nuclear, chemical, biological, conventional. He has a degree in nuclear engineering. He served 3 years in the Army as an explosive ordnance disposal officer. I guess he knows about that kind of thing. Assigned to the Defense Atomic Support Agency, Sandy Base, now part of Kirkland Air Force Base in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Let's see, he had access to the design details of every nuclear and thermonuclear warhead developed by the United States. This is a guy who knows a lot here, I think. After active duty, he then spent the next 13 years defining conventional and special ordnance. And we'll get into more of that as we go along. Wow. It's got a great imagination, and I think a great writing style. He and along with his wife, Vista, wrote these books, and I want to bring them both onto the program. So Lee and Vista, I'll start with Vista first, ladies first in this case. Vista, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you. It's a privilege to be with you.
Thank you very much. And Lee, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Dale, thank you very much, and I think we met in Florida.
I think that's where it was. I couldn't remember for sure. I think that was the first one that I ever went to. But I've read these books, and I guess to give the audience a little bit of a not only your background. Let's go back in there. Things I might have left out of your specialty of working with all these different types of weapons.
Well, it's my fascination. I really enjoyed it. I was commissioned. After getting my degree, I was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the Ordnance Corps. And after going to the 6-week basic at Aberdeen Proving Grounds, we had a chance to ask for specialty. And I had heard about EOD, and one of my fraternity brothers had gone that way a couple of years earlier. So I requested it and got it. And they had two slots open. I got one of them. And then when they started doing research, my initial posting was going to be to Yakima Firing Center in Washington State. And the Defense Atomic Support Agency, which taught all the courses on nuclear weapons, how to destroy them, how to maintain them. We taught dealing with contamination. The nuclear emergency team was responsible for cleaning up any accident or incident. And we were the primary team that had offered support worldwide. So So they asked for me to ask if I would change my assignment if I minded being sent to Albuquerque, and gee, it sounded like a good thing to me. So Vista and I talked about it for about 30 seconds and decided that's what we'd do. And it was a real experience. The first thing I discovered was that it was a very, very high end on both enlisted ranks and officers. That, for example, when I signed on the post, I was the only second lieutenant on the post.
Oh, okay.
We had more generals than we had second lieutenants by about four. And it was a real experience. And I got sent to the Nevada test site. I was involved in a lot of the design efforts that were on advanced warheads. And our team would be the one called on for if anything went wrong on any of the tests or in the stockpile, which DASA managed at that time, the five nuclear weapons stockpile. So our team, we had to be aware of everything that was in the stockpile, everything that could possibly on the drawing boards that might, you know, we might get a call at 3 o'clock in the morning to get on a plane and go to the Nevada test site. They have a problem. And we're supposed to know all about the test facilities that are going on. So it was a very intriguing situation.
It certainly sounds like it, and you are involved in a lot of things. As I'm reading your bio here on your website, LeeBoylanBooks.com, for those of you who be interested, should read this. It's very fascinating. But you were also responsible for the incineration and destruction, I guess you could say, of chemical weapons and other things back at the Rocky Mountain Arsenal, it said.
That's correct. We did a cluster bomb loaded with GB, what they call demilitarization, which means you had to open the cluster bomb, which was fused like some of the old World War II incendiaries and very similar to how a mortar round works.
Mm-hmm.
There's a button that comes out, and it's held in place by the other weapon. So when the cluster opens, the buttons pop out, and then the fuse arms. So you had to take these out and maintain pressure on the button, and then punch and drain the bomblet. And at that point, now you have a empty shell with an explosive booster in it and a fuse that's armed, and you have to get rid of that. It was fun.
I was going to say a nice relaxing job.
Yeah, it does. It keeps you on your toes.
I would say. And yeah. I know you weren't in the military with him, but when he came home for dinner, I got to imagine that some of those conversations were a little bit scary to you.
Well, honestly, we never had them.
Oh, okay, because you're not allowed to tell.
I very rarely knew anything that Lee was doing because he was, of course, sworn to secrecy, and I appreciated that, so I didn't delve. I did spend a good bit of time alone because not knowing where he was.
Mm-hmm.
Because he would leave to go on an assignment and not be able to tell me. In fact, one night I came home from an experience. I was out, I think, playing bridge, came home, which was typical in those days. Mm-hmm. I came home, and I'm driving along, and I see a man walking along the street in front of me, a man that was just kind of slugging along, and I thought, well, gee, that's strange. And finally I got closer. I realized it was Lee. I'm not really sure and don't remember where he had been, but he was exhausted, and he was coming home. They'd let him out from wherever.
Yeah, we were on a classified mission, and I was able to get an early flight, a late night flight rather than an early morning, and I got home early, and then, of course, I got a ride with another officer onto the base, and then I was walking from the from where he dropped me off home when she found me.
Wow. It's a good thing that you found him.
Yes, well, we've been together now the end of this month. We will have been married 57 years.
Well, congratulations to both
of
you on that.
So we have had a good bit of time to get to know one another and know about one another, but I'll tell you what's the truth. I learned more about him writing these books, truthfully, than I did in a good many years because his wisdom and his skill at storytelling. Really has been at times touching, moved me to tears, and at other times left me in hysterics. So,
well, I can understand the hysterics, and I suppose we should get right into that. If you want to know more about the background of Lee and Visser, you can go to their website, as I mentioned, Lee Boylan Books, and it's got a really great biography there of both of them. And as I was preparing for the program, we had that incident yesterday, the day before, in Hawaii, an accidental alarm went off, telling everybody a ballistic missile was coming in. And so you could see the panic in the news, at least, the pictures and things that they were showing on the news. And then I saw that there was a TV program called Designated Survivor on ABC. And as soon as I saw that, I said, wait a minute. I've seen this somewhere before. And that's when I went back and started reading your books again. So I guess I'm giving it away a little bit.
That's all right. the thing with Hawaii was interesting because we had an incident in the second book.
Mm-hmm.
Where the chairman or whatever of
Kim Jong-il
fired off a rocket at Hawaii. So we were kind of ahead of our time.
I understand that. All right, so let's get back to this, Lisa. Let's give a little bit of the premise of what these books are about, and then what motivated you to actually write these?
Well, I like to read fiction, especially I was a big Tom Clancy fan, and I like W.B. Griffin. In fact, I've had a chance to meet him on a couple of occasions. That's Bill Butterworth III. What happened is after 9/11, 2 years later, I've been watching, and it seemed to me that the United States had just forgotten about what happened in 2 years and moved on and didn't get the message that the terrorists are here. They want to kill us.
Mm-hmm.
That they want to kill us or make us convert to their religion. And there's no way around it. I mean, it's so obvious that people are in denial that they don't want to admit this. Now, I don't think every Muslim in the world wants to do that, but the ones that have the power and the ones that are fanatical will kill anybody. If another Muslim gets in their way, they get killed. They have no qualms about it, but they are determined. We are the great Satan, and Israel is the little Satan, and it is their God directed duty to wipe us out, and they won't quit unless we can kill them all. I don't see any way to stop them. No.
Mm-hmm.
That's the fanatics, or what I call the fundamentalists that take the Quran literally. So 2 years after that, I said, I'd been doing research on it, and I said, they start small, and every attack seems to get a little bit bigger than the one before it, or more complex. And in 1993, they tried to blow up the World Trade Centers with a car bomb, or actually with a van bomb, and they damaged the tower, but they didn't bring it down. So, being a good jihadist, you go back to the drawing boards and you figure a way to do it, and they did. In 2001, they took down the towers.
Mm-hmm.
So what comes next? That's a big event. Okay, they've got 5 airplanes hijacked. They really succeeded. So what would they do to be bigger than that? And I thought about it, and I said, well, the only way you're going to get bigger than that is going to be biological, chemical, or nuclear, and nuclear is the most probable. So I said, I'm going to write a book about how it can be done just so that maybe people will wake up and understand that it isn't fantasy, it isn't science fiction, it's something that can really be done. So I started writing The Rings of Allah, and I had never written fiction before. Well, with one exception, I was giving a talk to the Society of Mechanical Engineers, and it was my first book talk, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And after I went through my little blurb that I had worked up to try to explain the book, this one of these old engineers about my age in the back of the room says, "How'd you know you could write fiction?" And it was, your first time doing this, you've just written a book, you've never been an author before, and it really rattled me. I'm standing there going, Bob, 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 what am I going to say? And then it hit me. So I looked at him, I said, well, I wrote a lot of proposals to the government.
That cracked
the whole group up, and after that it was a really good friendly exchange. It was a great presentation after that.
I'm sure that you have a lot of experts there that could probably help you out, too, in addition to your own expertise.
Yeah, he came up and slapped me on the back after the meeting. Says, good answer.
We've got about a minute and a half till we have to take a break. But we're talking with Lee and Vista Boylan about their trilogy of books called Clash of Civilizations, and it's about the ability of the terrorists to get a hold of some nuclear weapons and the things that they do with them are not very good. Can you talk about a little bit, in that 1 minute we've got left, you could talk about where you came up with the idea for getting them from the Russians.
That was the hardest thing about the book. I sat down and said, how are they going to get this? Because you, contrary to a lot of beliefs, you cannot take some C4 and some uranium and sit in a garage and build yourself an implosion bomb. It's just
right.
impossible. So I said, I've got to come up with a credible, it is not doable scenario. And I thought, well, where can they get the uranium to build a bomb? And I started doing research, and I found out that the Soviets had left a live nuclear device in their test facility when they left.
Okay, I've got to stop you here for a second. I can hear the music coming up here. That means we're coming up to a break for the news. So we're going to talk about where you got the idea for getting these nuclear weapons, and then we're going to go into what they did with them. So stay tuned. We are here on Veterans Radio. We're talking about Clash of Civilizations. Don't go away. We'll be back in just a moment. And we are back on Veterans Radio this beautiful Sunday afternoon. My name is Dale Thronberry, and I get to be the host today. And we're talking with Lee and Vista Boyland about their trilogy of books, The Clash of Civilizations. And, Lee, we were just talking about where the your bad guys were getting a hold of a nuclear weapon. And I just thought about a movie that came out in the late 90s called Wag the Dog. And in that movie, Dustin Hoffman's character says that he was talking about a suitcase bomb and, you know, sneaking it into the country. And they were, this was a deception movie, you know, to protect the president at whatever, at that time, fictional story. But sometimes fiction really does come closer to truth than you even imagine, wouldn't you say?
Good fiction does.
Yeah.
Fiction should be based on real, you shouldn't violate the laws of physics and chemistry and you know, water does not flow uphill, no matter what you think.
as much so, as you try.
You have to. So, you know, all the good fiction writers, the stories are credible. They're credible, and they don't violate any physics laws or known facts. So you were asking me about the source. Well, as I said at right. the very end before the break, I discovered that a nuclear warhead had been left by the Soviets in the Kazakhstan osmoplastic test range in Kazakhstan. And we recovered it later, and there was rumors going around that there were one or two more that were there, but I never heard one way or the other on whether they were found or if they existed, but one was found. And I said, okay, if they left a warhead, that gives me the idea of how to create a source for the book. So we know that the Russians, the Soviets duplicated our Manhattan Project, the gadget, which was the test facility for the Fat Man, mm-hmm. the one that was tested in July 16th, 1945. So I said, if they did that, then maybe Stalin had two teams going, one to duplicate the Fat Man, which we know was true, and the other one to duplicate the Little Boy, which is a very simple gun-type nuclear weapon, entirely different than an implosion. And I said, why not? So I've created the story based on the fact that Stalin and Beria, who took over as the manager and director of the program, put the two teams in competition and said, one of you, whoever can get a nuclear device first wins. And the loser, unfortunately, is terminated. So that was the basis for the story. So, the first part of the book is the Russian KGB, the element that was breaking off to become the criminal element later.
Mm-hmm.
Finds the only survivor of the Little Boy team that knew where the weapons were. So the first part of the book is how they find them, and then it ends up with them selling it to a representative of Al-Qaeda. Then the middle part of the book is they figure out how to get the weapons out of into Pakistan or actually into Afghanistan in caves, and then they go about creating a way to bring them into the United States and put them in various cities. So there was five of these devices, and they found a U.S.-born Egyptian who spoke Farsi and Arabic and, of course, English. He was working on, he'd had a degree in engineering, and now he's working on his PhD in nuclear physics at the University of California. And they recruit him and put him in charge and say, you figure out, help us figure out how to get these in and where we can hide them in plain sight until we are ready to use it. So for the next 14 years, this procedure proceeds on where he creates a nuclear diagnostic facility. He has the money from the from Al-Qaeda and you know the other sources of money they have. So he creates five of these facilities. He puts them in high-rise buildings because they're upscale, very upscale facilities to cater to the stuff. The idea being, of course, you have a facility that has radiation stickers all over it. You have equipment that emit radiation, and there's no way anybody's going to discover that one of the instruments that you've hidden in a, in another room, it looks like, in fact, it's designated a neutron-induced gamma spectrometer, which is an actual element. It's that that test facility, what am I trying to say? The test instrument really exists, and it was used to analyze ways to identify explosives. And, the, and so they convert this into a gun-type weapon and put it in the facilities and maintain it until the time is ripe to detonate it. Toward the end of their book, the Iranian Ayatollah finds out about it and manages to take the program over from Osama bin Laden. And at the end of the book, he orders the detonation of all five devices, and he, and the timing is such that the one in Washington, D.C., will take out the entire U.S. government because the president, who happens to be Hilda Rodman, you might get a significant was giving a speech that terrorism is over, addressed to a joint session of Congress where she's announcing there's no more terrorism, everything's fine. And as she's walking out of the Capitol building onto the patio, the whole Congress is out there, the Supreme Court, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, just about that, the key elements of our government were all standing around as she walked out and the bomb goes off.
Wow.
So that leaves the sole survivor, which you mentioned at the beginning. And the interesting thing on sole survivor is you have to be in a different location, primarily a secure location.
Right. I thought, I thought they always did that anyway.
Yeah, they do. And so in this case, the sole survivor turned out being the Secretary of Homeland Security because his son had an accident and he had to fly out of town. So the designated sole survivor stayed in Washington and he was ended up being the sole survivor. He was in Albuquerque to visit his son. He's a retired Air Force Major General and was involved in the Defense Atomic Support Agency, which later became DITRA. And he finds himself president, statutory president, and he's all by himself. Everybody that he would normally work with is gone, and he has to cobble together a government and try to do whatever is necessary to pull the United States back together. And as he says in his first address to the nation, your credit card doesn't work, and neither does mine, and my wife is just as unhappy about that as you are. And what that means is the banking system has closed.
Right.
All the internet connections are gone. You can't withdraw money. You can't use your credit card. You have to survive on whatever cash you have in your pocket. And one of the things I like to do when I give book talks is said, how many of you have got $20 in your pocket or more, $20 or more? And very few people do. They got credit cards. They don't have,
right.
They only have a few bills. So what are you going to do if your bank, if you can't get money, your credit card's not accepted, and you have to live on what you have in your pocket? And, you know, it's a very frightening
it's a very real possibility.
Yeah.
I mean, even without the attacks, it's just the idea that these, you know, these banks all went, you know, if they all went down, then we're stuck.
Well, the five cities that were destroyed outside of Washington was Boston, New York, Atlanta, and the major communication centers.
Chicago.
Mm-hmm. So they were major communication centers, and that in itself is what paralyzed what could be done and needed to be done. And so the president had to find ways and people who happened. Yeah. As it turned out, the people that he chose kind of just walked in the door.
He said we're going to throw the rule book out the window. There is no rule book. The mm-hmm. only mission we have is to save the United States of America. America mm-hmm. first, period. Now, you've heard that lately from a person, and the interesting thing is, in 2008, when Trump first thought about running for president, we got, I don't know how, a bunch of emails from people from all in the country, and some from actually, I got one from England and one from Australia, saying, is Donald Trump your President Alexander? And I said, I don't know, but today I think I could say yes.
Well, maybe, that's for sure. That's
for
sure.
It's very similar. But so the rest of the story, it goes on about what he has to do to, the economic impact of losing five cities is catastrophic, just the impact. So you've got to solve that. You have to get the banking system back online. You have to get fuel so that people can have fuel for their houses and their automobiles. Mm-hmm. Food has to be delivered. You have to look at other countries that may decide it's a good time to say, oh, I think the Hawaiian Islands would be really nice in my pocket. Somebody else might say, yeah, I'd like to take a piece of the West Coast. So mm-hmm. he had to deal with this kind of thinking, plus the fact toward the end of the book, the cartels in Mexico start crossing the border because they feel they can get by with it, and they're literally coming in and assassinating people in border cities, and he has to deal with that. So the president has a plate full. And what he does is he finds competent people, gives them a job, and delegates and says, do whatever you have to do to accomplish your task.
Now, all of this didn't all happen in one book. This is what he's talking about right now, right. Transferred over into Behold an Ashen Horse, the middle book,
yeah.
Just for clarification. I want to make a point here that we talked earlier about accuracy. So much of the work that I do with Lee is research.
Mm-hmm.
I spend a good bit of time when we have people in different locations and even in where they are in, say, in a room, making sure that the description of where they are is accurate. And I do that to a point because people read our books and they'll come back and say, how did you do that? You know, did you go to Argentina or did you go to wherever? Because it's perfect. How did you get it that way?
The way we
get it that way is through research, and of course we mm-hmm. use the internet for that. But that's really a lot of what I do in terms of my interfacing with Lee.
Mm-hmm.
He real quick on the way we write together is that our computers are linked, and I don't ever know what he's going to write.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't plot the books; he just writes them as they come to him. I'll get two or three chapters from him on my computer, and then I read through, scan, do grammatical corrections and rewrites, and then it goes to hard copy, and then both of us read that. That's just mm-hmm. part of the system. But it's an 8-hour day or sometimes 14-hour day job. I mean, we work at this like we have a job to do in order to put these books together.
Well, I
not
think
only that, but... You know, Vista primarily helps on clothes, especially women's clothes, because I don't wear women's clothes.
Guys,
I don't know how to write about it.
The thing is that while you're reading his books, it is like reading a Tom Clancy type of story because it's so accurate as far as the information is concerned. And then your character development, I think that people will find also is so important because you become attracted to these various characters and you want to know how they live and where they live and you're very descriptive in how they do that. We're talking with Lee and Vista Boylan here. We're talking about their book, The Clash of Civilizations. We just went through the Rings of Allah where these guys blew up five American cities and only left one guy left who happened to be a retired military, which is probably very helpful in the particular story. And so now we're into the Behold of an Ashen Horse of how what is he doing here now?
He's building his
team, I know.
Well, one of the things that occurs is Kim Jong-il, not Un, the one in between, the one that's just passed away, decided that he was going to demonstrate to the world how powerful he was while the United States was, in his mind, incapable of doing anything. And he launched two ICBMs, one against the Seattle, Washington, and the other against Honolulu. And the Air Force, anticipating the problem, they had the Secretary of War. The President said, I don't need a Secretary of Defense. I need a Secretary of War because we've been attacked. Again, showing the pragmatic way that he looks at everything.
Right.
Said it stationed the, at that time, which was flying the aircraft, high-energy laser aircraft that was being based out, and it was out of one of the bases in California. They had it flying up and down the North Korean coast, and it took out the first missile that was launched going to Hawaii. The other one got away, and it was taken out by the ground-based interceptors based at Fort Greely in Alaska. But that was two, and, you know, we talk about, I don't worry about one or two missiles being fired at us, at least on the West Coast, because we have two bases with really good ground-based interceptors. Mm-hmm. Problem is, we don't have any on the East Coast, and if Iran launched one at us, there really isn't a whole lot we could do.
We really don't?
No, we don't. We don't have any ground-based interceptors. They're only at California, the I always have trouble remembering the name of it. That's where we launch satellites and stuff out of the...
Oh, Vandenberg, right.
Yeah. Vandenberg, and Fort Greely is the only place. And I think Fort Greely has 18 up that are ready to fire, and I don't know, at Vandenberg, probably 6 or 8. But
wow.
Your chances of taking out one missile with 6 or 8 countermissiles is very good.
Oh, the other issue that was going on during that book... was the fact that we had domestic just tumult all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone that wanted to protest and had something to protest about wanted to do it. Along with that, we had jihadists in the country.
Yeah, the sleeper cells.
Sleeper cells that were activated. And that was going on. And we tried through the book. Lee always puts in something that's kind of amusing. While a terrible... a confrontation was going on in Detroit, the militia led by a gentleman by the name of Colonel Gordy, who's a good old boy, comes along and he tells his militia guys, he says, look, we're going to go down there and get her done. We're going to take care of those jihadis.
Yeah.
So, that, like I said, he always comes up with something humorous, two or three humorous things. So it's not all heavy. You know, there's humor in it.
Yeah, and we introduced a young FBI female agent who is very bright and mm-hmm. extremely motivated and intuitive. And I just created her for one scene, and she worked. So she's now, the last book we put out is her story. It's the Triple Threat, which is the second book of the next series.
Okay.
She grows from being this overwhelmed little FBI agent in Buffalo, New York, whose boss didn't like her, to becoming a real star in the new administration. The third book that goes on that picks up after the retribution, because I'm getting ahead, sorry.
That's okay.
The main terrorist who masterminded this, Muhammad al-Madar, went on to form the caliphate. He was the... He finally figured out he was nothing more than the puppet for the Iranian Ayatollah, but at the beginning he thought he was really the caliph. Mm-hmm. And they formed the Islamic Empire, which took in the entire Middle East. And they were getting ready to go into Spain and Portugal and take them back. And they found out the United States wasn't quite as toothless as they thought it was, and they learned some hard lessons. But at the end of the story... the president says it's time for the retribution for what they've done to us, and he then totally destroys the Islamic Empire. And he says, basically, this is going to upset some people, but he says Islam is not compatible with the West, and they will not coexist peacefully with us. And I think that's very true of the fundamentalists, the people that take the Quran and the Hadith as if it was God's. You know, believe it's actually God's word, and you can't change one letter of one word, and you must do everything, which puts you in the fact that your job then is to convert the whole world to Islam. That's what they believe, and they believe they're doing God's work, and so you can't talk them out of it. So he just says Islam has to go. Religion is, and the ideology that goes with it is incompatible with Western civilization, and so when he takes out the the Islamic Empire, he takes out Medina, Mecca, and several other cities.
We got to remind people. We have to. We want to make sure we remind our audience that this is a fictional account. This hasn't happened, folks.
Exactly.
The potential exactly. for many of these things are always out there. But it is a great fictional story that is frightening. And I have to admit that I've read the three of them. I read them one right after another. I could not put them down, and then because I had to know what happened next, and how this whole thing was resolved. And it's still not resolved. I mean, in my mind, the books are done, but the world itself is not allowing us to resolve this.
Well, actually, the story jumps forward into what we call the Office of Analysis and Solutions, which picks up the characters. And the first one was Pirates and Cartels,
right.
which is the president has to deal with the Mexican cartels, and the Somali pirates manage to take an ocean liner, so they attract his attention also. And that flows into the last one that we've published, which is Triple Threat, and this is where Teresa really comes into her own.
This is your FBI agent?
Yeah. She has moved up very rapidly, and so the president sends her to South America to convince the three countries that there's an area there where the Paraguay, Brazil, and Argentina have all come together. It's like almost a peninsula that sticks out between them. So it's full of jihadists and cartels. And in fact, Osama bin Laden was down there in 1993 setting up deals with the cartels. That's true.
That's fact?
And,
okay.
Yeah, fact, yeah.
It's hard to separate it, isn't it?
It's very hard. I mean, considering all the sources of information that we do have out there, how do we determine what is right and what is true and what is not true, which is an issue that we're all going through in today's world.
Well, Lee built the storyline really around that fact that the jihadist training camps were started down there. So that's kind of where he got the idea to go with that plot.
In fact, it's mentioned in the second book, Behold the Ashen Horse, and again in the third book, America Reborn. And then it goes into Pirates and Cartels. And so what I do is I set these seeds and then they let them develop. And this becomes after a group of jihadists is caught coming across the Arizona border carrying cesium-137 canisters that would contaminate, each canister could totally contaminate a city.
What is that? Is it a poison gas or something?
No, it's an isotope of cesium-137, and it's an ideal thing to spread because it's a powder and it's got a number of uses. But this is probably an isotope that terrorists would go after if they could get their hands on it.
Okay,
So they caught this team coming across, and they figured, well, if there's one of these canisters, and there's probably more, and they traced it back to the tri-border area, which is this little area. It's actually not a little area. It's 1,000 square miles, basically, of an area of jungle. And if you go after them, and the terrorist you're after, let's say, is in Paraguay, and you start after them there, they step across the border to Argentina or Brazil and say, okay, I'm in another country. Now you have to go start all over again.
Mm-hmm.
So this has been going on for about 40 or 50 years now down there, and it's gotten progressively worse. So that became the theme of the last book, is that this area has to be shut down, and none of the three countries can do it because, first of all, especially in Paraguay, there's so many paid informers by the cartels that you can't you can't mount an operation without them finding out about it first.
Mm-hmm.
So Teresa was sent down there to convince the three governments that they had to work together and form a tri-border police force that would manage this area. And there was no borders. In other words, this police force could pursue out of the tri-border area into any of the countries, three countries. So, and that was a very interesting story.
Now, that we got ahead of ourselves there. We need to go back to America Reborn. That last book he's talking about was a Triple Threat.
Mm-hmm.
But in America Reborn, the president meets all kinds of new problems. He goes actually to England early on to reorganize what happened with NATO, because NATO's been wiped out, and he refuses to allow it to be reorganized.
No, the UN, too. He said the UN will not be reconstituted. It's a failed organization.
So in that particular book, we started introducing new characters. As I mentioned before, the characters move from one book to the other. Their lives developed, their characters developed, and in this particular book, we introduced new women, more women into the books.
Mm-hmm.
Big 6 foot tall women, very powerful women,
Amazons,
who
right?
Who are ready to take on anybody.
Well. Yes, it says women army rangers battle the Mudawin in Saudi Arabia and rescue a 12-year-old girl.
Exactly, they did. And that little girl, that was another wonderful story. She, little Julie became the president's pet.
Mm-hmm.
And he would fly her around with him while he was on Air Force One in America Reborn. And we've had more people write us and say, tell us how much they enjoyed reading about this little girl, because she was such a bright penny and so brave, very brave. She was kidnapped.
Right.
And the storyline, she was kidnapped by her Saudi father and taken back and literally held prisoner to try to force her into becoming a Muslim. And she refused, and they were going to stone her to death. And right at the point where they're ready to start stoning her, the two brave women come in and save her.
Come in for the rescue. Well,
they come in for the rescue.
We've got about 2 minutes left, and I can only imagine what your life is like when he comes up with these ideas, and you're going, "We're going where now?" where did that one come from, Lee? The thing that I've always been fascinated about with the military writers in general, and you, and all the other ones, is how you come up with these ideas, and then they kind of take on a life of their own, and it looks like that. So wherever, excuse me, oh, so where do our characters go next?
Well, it ended up with Triple Threat. It's a very large book. It's the biggest one we've written, because it completed the story of pirates and cartels, where they were taking out the cartels in Mexico, and then side trip to England. And then the president goes to England in the story to start a new organization called the Assembly of Nations, which will not be like the UN. And he said, we're not going to let small countries, I won't use the term that's going around the Internet right now, from having the same vote as the major powers. So I'm thinking about continuing the story on. I'm also thinking about another satire, which we haven't even mentioned.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, we got to go.
Thank you so much for having us.
I'm not quite yet. I want to thank both Lee and Vista Boylan for being on Veterans Radio today. I want to make sure that you go to Lee Boylan Books. You can find out all kinds of information. He's got a lot of his thoughts and ideas down there already. You can go to Amazon and order any of these in hardback or in Kindle. And I tell you, you really should read these, even if it's just if you like adventure stories. I think that The Clash of Civilizations is one of the best adventure stories I've ever read. And I want to thank both of you for being on the program today.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having us.
Godspeed.
Godspeed to you, too. Thank you very much. All right, folks, that's it for another version of Veterans Radio. We'll be back next week. And until then, you are dismissed.